This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
In the tradition of Stephen Ambrose's Band of Brothers, The First Men In tells the remarkable story of the American paratroopers who took on one of the most important and dangerous missions of World War II. On the eve of D-Day, the 82nd Airborne Division parachuted into key positions along the Normandy coast, spearheading the assault on Fortress Europe. Putting themselves between the vulnerable landing beaches and relentless enemy assaults, the lightly armed paratroopers purchased with their blood the critical hours the Allies needed to get ashore, and thus helped secure the success of the greatest amphibious invasion in history. My guest is author Ed Ruggiero. His new book is First Men In, U.S. Paratroopers and the Fight to Save D-Day. Good afternoon, Ed.
Hello there.
Thanks for being with us. We appreciate your time.
Absolutely.
I have to tell you, your book is one of those, and there's not many, there's one of those books that sort of grabs you by the throat on the very first page of the prologue and just does not let you go. It's an amazing. Tell us, if you can, by way of introduction, how you begin this book. It's an incredible story of this guy who, this book about paratroopers, it literally starts with a guy falling through the air.
It does, and that's the reaction I had when I met these fellas and listened to their stories, and was just I interviewed probably 100 veterans over the course of probably 2 years to write this book and the previous one about the same unit. Roy Creek, the fellow whom you mentioned, who's right up front, grew up in New Mexico, never learned to swim, and of course, in his first few minutes in the war, he lands in water well over his head. His equipment, his own equipment, almost drowns him. His parachute comes down on top of him. He's trying not to panic, thrashing around, manages to escape by cutting loose all of his gear, but then, of course, has to go back in the water to retrieve his weapon and ammunition. So two times in the first half hour of the war, he had to go into water over his head. And then later on in the following morning, or after the sun came up on June 6th, he had to cross about a 1,000-yard expanse of a flooded area. The Germans had flooded this area to inhibit the Allies. And I can only imagine how terrifying it must be for someone who's a non-swimmer to have to do that, to step off knowing that, you know, if you step into a channel or a hole, that could be it for you. But Roy Creek was a leader, and he knew his men were counting on him, and they certainly were looking at him, and he did the right thing. It's just incredible bravery before he ever saw any Germans.
My guest is that we're talking with Ed Ruggiero. His new book is First Men In. And Ed, you some of the other books you've written too are as well. We want to mention those. Duty First, A Year in the Life of West Point, The Making of American Leaders, Combat Jump. You really have incredible expertise about not only this time in American history, but also the people who put on those uniforms and risk their lives.
Well, I think that I had a lot of, being a veteran myself, I had a lot of cachet with the World War II veterans. Many of these men had not spoken about the war for 50 years. A lot of the families, grandchildren and grandchildren I met really didn't know very much about Grandpa's experiences, but these men opened up to me, for which I'll be eternally grateful, and I'm certainly honored by their stories. The fellow who introduced me around, I met when I was up at West Point researching Duty First, a fellow by the name of Jack Norton, who served with the 82nd Airborne Division from the summer of 1942 through four combat jumps and five major campaigns. And at the end of the war was a lieutenant colonel and eventually retired as a three-star general. But he was the guy who originally turned me on to these stories. And I talked to him almost 60 years after the invasion of Sicily in 1943, which is what my book Combat Jump is about, and the love that he had for his men, his comrades, was still evident.
The author is Ed Ruggiero, and the book, a terrific book, folks, is The First Men In, U.S. Paratroopers and the Fight to Save D-Day. This book is, of course, a little close to my heart, my dad being a veteran of the 82nd Airborne. He joined in 1957 after he left North Georgia Military College. And I was talking to him today about it, and he said he was an assistant G3 air, and he was a first lieutenant doing a major's job.
Yeah.
Tell us about Ed, some of the other men that you met and some of the stories that they had to share with you.
Well, because I started my research just a few years ago, or the interviews at any rate, the only fellows who were left with us were very young in World War II. So what I wound up doing was really telling this story from the private's point of view and the point of view of the lieutenant and the sergeant, because those were the youngest fellas at the time. One of those guys, a Boston native named Bob Murphy, lied about his age to get into the Army, and in 1944, when he jumped into France, was all of 18 years old. He went in as a pathfinder, jumping about 30 minutes ahead of the main body to mark the drop zones. And spent all of June 6th and June 7th in a foxhole overlooking what became a tiny little country bridge or bridge on a country road called La Fierre, which became a critical flashpoint in the paratroopers. Their mission was, of course, to keep the Germans from counterattacking the invasion beaches. So I wrote this from the point of view of Bob Murphy and his peers, his comrades, guys whom he said didn't write history, but they made history.
Tell us as well. Tell us about the 325th, the glider infantry.
So the 82nd Airborne Division was made up of a combination of paratrooper units. Those are men who jump out of the airplane wearing parachutes, and augmented by glider infantry. So these are fighting units that they're not trained to parachute, but they're trained to come in on these gliders. And just the fact that anyone would want to climb on one of those, or would could make himself do that. These the British-made gliders were great big plywood affairs that the troops called flying coffins. The American-manufactured gliders called Wacos were canvas over aluminum tubing. They had an inauspicious start because in a demonstration back here in the States in 1942, a bunch of VIPs in St. Louis were up in a glider, and when the tow plane cut it loose, the wings fell off, and the mayor of St. Louis and the whole all the rest of the people on board just plummeted to the ground. I'm sure horrifying the people in the stands who thought they were coming to watch a show. The guys who went in on gliders on D-Day faced extraordinary challenges. The gliders, of course, are slow moving; they don't make any noise. That's an advantage, but they're so slow moving, and when they come in low, of course, the countryside is sprinkled with Germans who merely have to look up to have a big fat target to shoot at. And then when the gliders landed and the fields turned out to be smaller than they expected, so many of them crashed into the very thick hedgerows or into obstacles that the Germans had put up to thwart the gliders. So they really took extraordinary risks, the glider troops, and of course suffered casualties because of that. But they made up by the time all was said and done, about almost 30% of the combat power of the 82nd Airborne Division.
Wow, that's one thing that most people have no idea. When they think of D-Day, they think of the folks coming in on the beach, and they might think of the paratroopers, but I don't think many people out there knew that there were a lot of guys going in the dead of night on gliders, completely silent, and just hoping to land in a field.
Yes. Well, and in fact, probably the greatest... one of the greatest feats of glider piloting on D-Day was pulled off by the British 1st Airborne. They went in, three gliders full of infantry went in to capture some bridges on the far eastern side of the invasion area, and the pilots put the gliders almost directly on top of the bridges. So when the men came out, they immediately seized these bridges, and that allowed them to control the left flank of the entire Allied invasion area. But when you visit Normandy, and any of your listeners who have a chance, I urge them to do so, and you visit that far eastern end in the British sector, you can see just how close these glider pilots, and we're talking, you know, young men 25 or 26 years old, how closely they landed to their objectives. And that's another thing that we can lose perspective on is the youth. You know, we think of the World War II generation, and most of us, when we close our eyes and picture that, these are people who are older.
Right,
well,
right.
Not at the time. Bob Murphy, 18, one of the fellows I interviewed from Tennessee by the name of Ken Russell, who remembered on the flight over that his high school class was graduating back home in Tennessee as he was sitting on this airplane headed for the war on the continent. Ken Russell was one of the unfortunate fellows who jumped out right over the town square in a little town called St. Mary Eglise. The Germans were already out and about because there was a fire. A building was burning on the town square, and the French were out trying to put it out with a bucket brigade, and of course, the German guards turned out because it was after curfew when this unfortunate plane load of paratroopers from F Company was dropped right over the town square. Ken hit the roof of the church and rolled off. Another paratrooper by the name of John Steele, his chute actually got hung up on the steeple. And in the 1962 movie, The Longest Day, Red Buttons plays this fellow who was just hanging there while the bells were ringing right next to his head. And, of course, he was captured by the Germans and eventually liberated before by the Allies.
I should say, too, that not many people will remember that the late Senator Strom Thurmond was actually on one of those gliders that went in the very early morning. He was a passenger sitting, and he was actually in his 40s. He resigned a judgeship and enlisted, and was one of the oldest ones in that unit. And he tells the story of they went into an orchard. They thought it was a field, but it was full of trees. And the glider was just completely torn up. And I think he said, if I'm not mistaken, they had some piece of equipment with them that they were going to use, completely destroyed. And it is amazing what was the attrition like for the gliders and the paratroopers? Because you could just look up and see them coming.
Yes, and they did suffer fairly heavy casualties, although not as badly as Eisenhower and his headquarters people expected. Eisenhower's principal air advisor determined that the paratroopers could suffer up to 70% casualties. That's killed, wounded, missing, and captured. And warned Ike of this. So Eisenhower had to mull over this decision. The paratroopers' role was so critical to securing the beaches that he had to decide, well, is the prospect of that horrendous number of casualties worth what we have to do? And he finally decided yes. So there's a famous photograph of Ike talking to some paratroopers right before they board up. He's sitting in a dress uniform. They already have their faces blackened with camouflage. But it gives it a new perspective because he knows, they don't know, but he knows of these the terrible predictions for these men. And what always strikes me about that is he could have just stayed in his headquarters someplace, but he went out to look them in the eye, knowing that there was a chance that he was sending a lot of them to their deaths. And I think that takes, just making the decisions difficult enough, but to go out and look them in the eye and talk to them face-to-face had only to increase his burden.
Army veteran and author Ed Ruggiero, his new book is First Men In, U.S. Paratroopers and the Fight to Save D-Day. Ed, what is it you think that most Americans perhaps don't know or don't even understand about this time in American history?
Well, I think that, and I think this is true of history in general, certainly as an historian I'm conscious of this, is we have to remember that the people we're reading about, they don't know how the story is going to turn out. So it's, when you watch a movie, whether it's Saving Private Ryan or Band of Brothers, or you read a history book such as this one, and in the back of your mind, maybe unspoken, you just figure, well, it's hard, certainly, but they know that we're going to win eventually, but in fact they don't. Had the invasion failed, there was no plan B, and there was no way to pull the soldiers off the beaches, had the ones that had already landed. So during D-Day, when things were really bad on Omaha Beach, there was a point during which General Bradley, who commanded all the American ground forces, thought that they were maybe going to have to stop sending the successive waves onto Omaha Beach because they were just getting chewed up. But there was they had no means to pull off the men who were already there. So they're really this was quite an undertaking because there was no backing off. Once you made the decision to go, you were going no matter what. Now, of course, the Allies pulled off one of the great ruses of all time and managed to fool the Germans as to where the invasion was going to be, which is just a mind-boggling accomplishment in terms of keeping secrets, that you could have 2 million people involved in an operation and still not have anything leak out as to where the invasion was going to be.
Yeah, one wonders if you could do that today, it would pop up on somebody's blog.
it's very difficult to completely shut down communications today. As units who are deployed, combat units today who are deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan, find, you know, it's difficult to shut that down.
Hey, Ed, what do you think, you know, the book Band of Brothers and the movie, I'm a big fan of that. It was just great, great stories. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, did that get it right or is it way off?
Well, I will have to defer to the paratroopers that I knew who did, in fact, think that many of that, what was portrayed there, got it right. Interestingly, the movie Saving Private Ryan, which sort of started all this in Steven Spielberg's World War II work, the individual details and the environment was right, but of course that's a Hollywood story. There's, you know, nobody's wounded and has to be carried off. There's you know, somebody disappears from Tom Hanks's unit, they don't have to, not a wounded person that they have to take care of. So it's sort of a Hollywood ending, although there was a family from upstate New York who had a number of sons involved, and although they did, one of their sons was a paratrooper and was eventually sent home, didn't happen exactly like that, but it certainly was the inspiration for the story Saving Private Ryan.
Ed Ruggiero, his new book is First Men In, U.S. Paratroopers and the Fight to Save D-Day. A terrific book full of fantastic stories, just one after another, of the men who were there and fought so bravely and demonstrated such great leadership. And Ed, thank you so much for the book. It really is a beautiful book.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
This interview will be archived in its entirety on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SeavillePodcast.com.
You've been listening to WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. The show can be heard every Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 o'clock on News Radio 1070 WINA. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SeavillePodcast.com. If you enjoyed the show, why not check out our site for hours and hours of archives of Coy's show? You'll also find other radio programs, arts features, public affairs coverage, and more.